didn't even know if people were going to come. Like, honestly, we didn't know if anybody was going to show up. We were like, man, like going into it, we were sweating.
Big, massive fish that pull hard and they're hard to get to eat. So it just seemed like fun.
Twitched it a little, let it sit, and I saw the tail come up, and I see a little poof of mud, and I set the hook, and it took off.
You're just like locking eyes. You're like, oh, all right.
Welcome back to another episode of Wildlife Outdoors. Today we got a foursome for you guys. It's the first time we've had two guests on, so hopefully that's exciting for y'all. But Jose's back for this episode, so we're glad to have him back. And along with him, we have Grant from Hill Country Flyworks and Landon from Honey Hole Angling. So how are y'all doing, man?
Great, man. Hey, happy to be here.
Doing great. I'm, pumped.
And we're happy to have y'all.
And that we could, me and Grant could be together is just even better.
Is cool. This is the first time I've done this format. It's cool.
It's definitely different. It takes some getting used to, for sure.
Well, it'll be interesting.
For sure. So I guess we can kind of do a round table if y'all want. And I guess we can start with Landon and then Grant afterwards. Just kind of tell a little bit about yourself and about y'all's businesses and so on and so forth.
All right. So I've been fly fishing. Well, let me back up. I've been hunting almost my whole life, fishing almost my whole life. I really started fly fishing around 2012, 2013. Was a fishing manager of an Orvis store for a couple of years. And then a few years ago, started a fly fishing podcast with some of my buddies, just like Russell, you and Jose did here. And have a YouTube channel and fish as much as I can, which is not very often these days, unfortunately.
I'm in the same boat. What about you, Grant?
I'm Grant. I'm a full-time brewer, and I've been dabbling lightly in fly fishing since about 2011, but COVID hit and kind of hit the ground running and really took off with it and gained a deep passion during that time. So I started up a little kind of passion project called Hill Country Flyworks and just post videos and pictures and that kind of thing. So that's pretty much it.
Seems like you're pretty consistent with that. You've been posting pictures and videos nonstop, it seems.
Yeah, man. Well, I mean, I'm having fun with it, man. And like, I get to wrap up all these new interests, you know, like I've really been getting into photography and videography. And so it's kind of a natural outlet to kind of flow all that stuff through. And it's just been a really fun, unique experience. And also just like kind of building the community or like being more involved with the local community has been really cool too. So it's just kind of an outlet for that as well. So
right, that's awesome. And that's one thing that I've noticed about the fly fishing community is it's a little bit more of a community than some other, you know, sports or outdoor recreation. And it's something that I just really enjoy being a part of. So
for sure, there's tons of cool, unique, interesting people in this community for sure.
Thanks for the compliment, Grant.
So your passion of photography and videography, awesome videos by the way, but I see that Landon's wearing that Iron Fly hat. So were you the one who did the recording for the video that they showcased there?
So Landon, or myself, Landon, Zach Harris, and we had a couple other people, Mike Torres, were involved in the actual shooting of they kind of helped gather a bunch of the film for that video. And then I'm kind of the one who tried to do my best to piece it all together and turn it into kind of the final product.
Grant edited it, which was the big, obviously you guys know, y'all do editing. So, which is the hardest part of the the fun part was filming. So Grant, myself, Zach Harris, all held cameras. Mike Torres let us use some of his equipment and was helpful in consulting on some things. And then Grant sat down and edited it And I think I watched it, like, I went over to your house and watched it with you, and we talked about a few changes, got those knocked out, and then showed it at Ironfly. So,
dude, that's sick. So how long did that process take you guys from, like, starting, like, I guess the inception of the idea and then the final product?
I think once we decided we wanted to do it, it was pretty, the hard thing about the film was, obviously we filmed at a real recovery retreat while the retreat was going on, and you don't know what you're going to get. And so that was probably the most nerve-wracking part, was, okay, this is kind of what we want to do, but you can't control these guys catching fish. You can't have a camera on everybody 24/7. So you just hope that you catch these awesome moments, which we did capture a lot of them, but then there were also some that were missed. So you just do the best you can and get, you know, try to, it was hard to plan going into it what the outcome would be. So you just have to go into it and shoot as much as you can. And then we would talk about, okay, we would like to get this shot at the retreat. We would like to get this shot at the retreat, of other things like courageous conversations, which is really difficult because that's a closed room. So you can't really film the courageous conversation. So we had to say, hey, can we film you guys sitting in the chairs pretending to talk for like 5 minutes? And then you guys can do, we'll leave and you guys can do your thing. So we kind of had to work around some of those things. And then Grant, I'll let you talk about the editing, because I don't know how long it took you, but I know you worked on it for a long time.
Yeah, that was kind of just, so basically in between the retreat was what, in April, mid-April or something. And then the, we showcased it in October. And so that was kind of the timeline to get it all finished. And the first couple months was just kind of leisurely kind of chopping down footage and getting like rough.
Grant, how many hours of footage did we end up having total that we had to trim down? I want to say it was like 40 hours.
It was a lot for sure. So yeah, it was just kind of like, it was a little overwhelming at first, just because I'm new, I'm especially this was my first, like, I don't know what you'd even call it, like something like a real polished film that I was trying to do. And so it was definitely overwhelming with, you know, just dealing with that much material. And so it was just kind of like initially just chopping it down, trying to get it more manageable. And then as time started kind of dwindling was when the heat was on, and started really grinding towards, you know, the end of summer and kind of coming into the last couple final months, really just getting everything dialed in. And I mean, yeah, it was a daunting process, but it was rewarding. It's fun.
Well, I think you guys did an awesome job, and I realized we didn't provide any context before we kind of got into specifics. So if you weren't able to make it to the Ironfly, which is unfortunate because it was a fantastic event. Beer was great. The people were awesome. And the video was spectacular. It was beautiful and really, really moving. And if it's ever done in the future, which I don't know what you guys have planned, but definitely recommend you guys checking it out. But yeah, so they showed this video for Real Recovery, and it was awesome. And I mean, I looked around. I don't think there was a single person in there who didn't feel something, and which I think is probably the goal when you're trying to make, you know, these types of films and such. So, you guys would know more about Real Recovery and what the goal of this film was for, if you would like to touch on that and give the listeners a little bit more context. Everything.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about Real Recovery. So for you guys that don't know, Real Recovery is a nonprofit organization that takes men that have or have had cancer on free fly fishing retreats, where they get to fly fish one-on-one with a fishing buddy. It's over a weekend, so they get to fish one-on-one with a fishing buddy over a weekend, and they get group counseling that is cancer-specific, which they call courageous conversations. And so basically the retreat is intervals of fish for a couple hours, courageous conversations, fish for a couple hours, courageous conversations, meals thrown in there, all of that stuff. It's very well run by the retreat organizers. And I have never met someone who did not regret going on a retreat. And a lot of guys that do go on the retreats say that it's life-changing. And the reason for that is, as men, we do not want to talk about our problems. We want to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We get cancer, we're just going to take the punch on the chin and move on. And so a lot of these guys that have cancer, it ranges. Some of these guys have been in remission for 10 years, but they've never talked to anybody about their cancer and they get a lot out of the retreat. Some guys have passed away within a month after going on the retreat. And so it's wide ranging in you know, the types of cancer and the stage that they're in. But everyone that I know that has gone on a retreat has found a benefit of going on a retreat. And so we did an Iron Fly to raise money for them because me and my buddies have been volunteering as fishing buddies for a couple of years, and they COVID kind of hurt their fundraising. And so we set out with a lofty goal to raise $10,000 for Real Recovery. And that would pay for one retreat. So one retreat for 12 to 15 men ends up costing about $10,000. So our goal was to pay for a retreat with the fundraising. And I don't think I've made this public announcement. We ended up a little bit short after our costs were taken out. I think, you know, after the retreat, we were at like 11,000, but we had expenses that put us under 10, and someone heard about it and they made a donation to make it a flat 10. So we did end up hitting our goal. I actually just found this out like 2 weeks ago. We ended up hitting our goal, even though the numbers at the end of, after the retreat, we were very close, which was exciting. And 10,000 for us to do an event like that, where we had never done it, we had conversations like, man, that's pushing it. Like we felt like that was a ton of money and that we maybe even should have made it a little bit lower. So we're all pumped that we hit 10 grand. And, Grant was a huge help because we did it at his brewery that he works at, and got the band and a bunch of other stuff that helped us out. So it was awesome. We're planning on doing another one. Not this year. We are going to move it to the spring because we had an unfortunate conflict with another friend of ours that was doing an event that we don't want that to happen again. So we're going to move it to the spring when we know that there's no other fly fishing events going on. So spring of next year, be on the lookout. We're going to do Iron Fly again.
Dude, heck yeah.
That's awesome.
And whoever that donor was, I mean, shout out. That was awesome. Stepping up like that.
Yeah. They didn't want to be known. The donor didn't want to be known, and they ended up about a $1,500 donation.
Oh, wow.
To make it an even 10,000. They did not go to the event, I was told, but they just heard about it secondhand and was like, oh, that sounds awesome. I want to make it 10. So, if you're listening to this, whoever donated, very, very appreciative of that. That's awesome. Yeah,
seriously. Thank you. I mean, that's incredible, dude. Just not even going, but then still finding it in your heart to want to go and do something like that. It's pretty awesome. Pretty cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And the fact that y'all pulled it all together, I mean, 10 grand is a lot of freaking money, like you said. And so how did y'all even come about wanting to do this?
We didn't even know if people were going to come. Like, honestly, we didn't know if anybody was going to show up. We were like, man, like going into it, we were sweating. Because we also knew that I'm good friends with Chris Fowler, and he was having a awesome party the same day. Mm-hmm. And we had a conversation before, can we switch it? Like, it was just, we were both too locked in and had people coming in to switch it. So we were like, people are going to go to Fowler's party. People are going to go to our, it's splitting the mm-hmm. community in a way, which mm-hmm. we didn't want to do. And I know that there were people that had already committed to Fowler's party that are good friends of mine. And so they weren't able to come. And so we were like, man, is this not going to work out? It ended up, I talked to Fowler. They had a blowout. We had a blowout. It was awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah, me and Jose were debating on going. We're going to try to come to Iron Fly for a little bit and then haul out a little early to try to make it down to the coast. But it just didn't seem like it was in the cards. So we chose to stay at Ironfly.
Yeah, like there's just no way we can swing that. So yeah, we just ended up going to Ironfly and do not regret it. It was a phenomenal time.
Same. And shout out to Faust Brewing. The beer was part of the reason we stayed.
Sweet. Heck yeah. 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 We were all feeling it, I think. But
dude, I didn't even know New Braunfels had a brewery like that. Dude, the beer was, great. And the place was sweet.
Thank you very much. Yeah. That we just kind of did big renovations and blew it out. And, this past March. So we're going on our year anniversary party, and it was fun to have an event like that at kind of a newly renovated beer garden and that whole deal. So it's awesome.
Also want to shout out all the people that went, because, and maybe Grant, you can, talk on this too, but I got feedback afterward that the people that were there, the staff loved because of how nice they were. And compared to other events, maybe that are at the brewery is what they're comparing that to.
They said that everybody at the event, all the bartenders were singing everybody's praises about how respectful and kind and how just nice of a group of people all the fly fishermen were and women. So that was great to hear that the community represented me well and vice versa.
Yeah. Nice. Did you guys get tattoos? I don't remember.
I did not know.
I didn't know.
No. Did you guys?
No.
I was standing there and I was debating and I was just like, nah, I don't think I'm going to.
Next year.
There's a long line too.
Yeah, the line was insane. That was another reason why I was like,
I don't know.
The last people to leave was the tattoo artist. Honestly, he worked the hardest at the event. He was booked from beginning to end and was the last to leave at like 10 or 11 p.m.
No break. Carlos, why don't you shout him out?
Yeah, Carlos, White Lighter Society on Instagram. He's a tattoo artist in Austin.
Yeah. Crushed.
And he was having a blast, man.
That's so cool. And that's a really cool idea, too. There were, if I'm not mistaken, there were a few people there who got their first tattoo there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Did you really? Dude.
That was my very first one. Yeah.
You got the glot on your thigh, right?
Yeah, I did. Yep.
Dude, my dad got a tattoo. I remember going to the doctor with him as a kid, and he had to get a shot. And if he saw the needle, he would pass out. And he almost passed out while getting a tattoo. And I'm just like, just blown away that he even got one while we were there. So,
man, that's awesome.
See, I hate needles. Like when it comes to shots or anything like that, it's not my thing. And then when I was probably what I was like 18, maybe 19, I'll say when I got my tattoo.
I think like as soon as you turn 18, you went to the.
Yeah, I think it was as soon as I turned 18, I went there in San Marcos and got a freaking stupid tribal. It looks like a dude's pants across my back. I hate the thing, but I got it, and it took like 3.5 hours. And then after that, I was like, tattoos aren't really much. Like, I'd much rather get a tattoo than get a shot. But then after seeing it a couple years later, I'm like, dude, I hate this freaking tattoo. So I haven't got another one since because I regret that one.
See, and my thing with tattoos, like, I grew up in a family that were very traditional, like super hyper traditional. And I was always told, like, never get tattoo, whatever, this and that, the other. My mom threatened to disown us if we ever got one, right? So just like it got ingrained in my and it's kind of funny because all of my siblings, they all have tattoos. Like my brother's got sleeves, my sister's got them. I mean, I just haven't. And over the years, like I've just become more open minded to it. And I really like tattoos. I like the idea of tattoos. I'm just waiting for like the perfect one before I want to like commit to that. Because if I'm gonna have something on my body for the rest of my life, like it has to be like meaningful. It has to be exactly what I want. And I have an idea. Actually, I don't know if I've told Russell, but I have an idea for one. I'm just waiting for the right time. So we'll see. Maybe that'll be next year at Ironfly.
Now I want to say too, like having a tattoo artist at a fly fishing event wasn't our idea. Like Fowler has them down at the fly trap all the time. We just thought it was a good idea and did it because people are like, oh, that was such a good, like, that wasn't my idea. Like I've been to other events. I mean, dude, Trout Fest this year had a tattoo.
Yeah,
artist.
Exactly.
They did.
So this wasn't our idea. We just knew it'd be popular, maybe get some people out there, and another way to raise money for Real Recovery, because everybody that got a tattoo made a donation at the event to Real Recovery. I think what was the minimum 50. Grant? Like $50. Mm-hmm. Direct donation to Real Recovery, and that got you a tattoo. So
after it was all said and done, were you guys surprised at the turnout that y'all had?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. From being scared that no one would be there to the turnout that we had was awesome. People showed up and a lot of people stayed all night, which was awesome. And, a lot of people showed up later because I think, you know, a lot of people didn't want to tie flies, but they wanted to come hang out for all the auctions and everything like that. So pretty early on, it was slow, but you know, by the time fly tying was being wrapped up and then we were doing the raffles and auctions and all that kind of stuff, there ended up being a bunch of people there.
Yeah. By the time we showed up, the fly tying was well underway and, there wasn't really room to even go in the tying room. So me and Jose actually tied ours out in the beer garden, I believe.
Oh, nice. Was the band still playing at that point when y'all showed up? And
yes.
Were they playing when we showed up or did we show up
I'm
right before?
I'm pretty sure because I remember hearing music like distinctly.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, because that was kind of one of the things where it's like, man, if we could next time we do it, I think we're going to try to maybe extend those guys' sets because I know a lot of people were – We're ready to hear some more music after the film was done being showed and all that. But
yeah, we showed up quite a bit before the film. So what happened was we wanted to go try to get on some Rios. And so we went and fished Brushy Creek that morning. And so we were up there fishing Brushy. And then, of course, you can't go fish Brushy and then not stop into Living Waters. So we stopped into Living Waters and then we went and showered and Longhorns were playing, so we watched a little bit of that game. You know how that goes. I know.
little did you know you could have just shopped Living Waters at the Ironfly because they had a booth set up.
Right. Yeah, sure. But we stopped in there for a little bit, and then so we got out there. I'd say probably what maybe 3-4 o'clock is when we got to the event. Jose,
somewhere around there. Yeah,
yeah, something like that. So we weren't there like really late, but we got there later than we had anticipated on getting there. But do y'all have like a total head count of how many people showed up?
Nobody ever counted.
It was a lot.
What do you think, Grant?
What, 200-300 people probably, including everybody else that was there? Maybe
I would say probably 200 people.
Yeah.
And there were a few people there that weren't part of the event, but I would say a majority of the people were part of the event.
Yeah, it was a good turnout for sure. So how did that even come about with Honeyhole even getting to the point to where they could do that? I mean, because that's a big feat and y'all pulled it off pretty damn well.
We have been talking about it honestly for a long time before we even did the event, and we had had talks with Real Recovery probably up to a year before the event, and then just kind of planning it, and then at some point we just decided let's do it. Our biggest obstacle was the venue. And once Grant came into the picture, basically, and had a relationship with the brewery because he worked there, that's when really things kicked off because we had queried 15 to 20 venues in the Hill Country area, either breweries or distilleries. And basically the feedback was, you guys are going to have to pay to do an event here. And our thing was, we're not going to pay to have an event where we're trying to raise money for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And their response was basically, if you don't pay, someone else will.
Yeah.
And so they wouldn't even do like, hey, we'll make you a sponsor. They're like, oh, if you make us a sponsor, we'll give you 20% off. Well, 20% of $5,000, which was what some of these people were charging to have an event there, still wasn't that saving that much money. And so ultimately when the brewery was like, yeah, you guys can have the event here, you know, we'll make money on, you know, the drinks and the food, and you know, you guys can do your thing. And they even paid for the band for us.
Wow.
So like that was huge. That's what made it doable, because before that it really wasn't. Unless we did it in a public place, but I don't know. We always like the idea of doing it at a brewery or a distillery.
Yeah.
Just because they have the seating, they have drinks. A lot of times there's food. It just makes it easier instead of having to bring all that stuff in separately.
Exactly. And then there's all different licenses depending on the venue. And you know, some places you're like, oh, well, you can have this, but you can't have that. You can have beer, but not liquor. Or you have to have a certified, you know, such and such to serve it. And so there's a lot of stipulations on some other venues. So that's awesome that it all came together like that at Faust. So we talked a little bit when we first got on about fishing and whatnot. Obviously, we're all here. We're all fishermen. But now is the time of year to get on some carp. And so that's kind of the main reason we wanted to have Grant on, because I'm just getting tired of seeing all the carp, really, and not knowing how he catches them. So I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit, man. You mind if I do that?
For sure, man. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've caught two carp, and I've never said this on the podcast, but the first one I caught was an unintentional foul hook, right?
So
this first carp that I caught was a couple days ago. I think, what's today, Monday? So it was last week on Tuesday. I caught my first carp that I actually hooked in the mouth. And I'm addicted now. I'm 100% addicted.
We were talking a little bit about it, man. The tug is the drug. It's a fun feeling for sure.
So how exactly did you get into carp in the first place?
Oh, man, I don't know. I guess, I had kind of just seen people doing it. And, you know, I was real interested in red fishing. And that's kind of the most, I guess, comparable fish to, freshwater fish. So I don't know, man. There's a lot of aspects that I think intrigued me. But, you know, they're big, massive fish that pull hard and they're hard to get to eat. So it just seemed like fun. But.
Right. And that's one thing that I've talked to a few. I mean, living in Arkansas is a little different because a lot of people here are the, you know, stereotypical purists. They only want to fish trout streams and stuff. So when I talk to people up here that fly fish, they think it's the strangest thing that I'm out here chasing carp with a fly rod. And they're like, why would you even want to fish for that?
Yeah. And that's common, I think, anywhere, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. I still see people down here that are like, what? You're fishing carp? What the heck? Like, it's a thing.
It's like, yeah, have you been taken to your backing on a fly rod 3-4 times on one fish yet?
Exactly. Yeah, for sure.
So if you had to pick one go-to fly for carp, what would it be?
Fish chase fly scorpion. That is the only fly, in my opinion, that you will ever need. You tie it in different colors, whatever you need, but that fly will get it done.
Haven't you tied up some of those, Jose?
You attempted to, yeah. They don't come out nearly as good.
Well, nobody can compare to Chase. Oh, so Chase, like, if you're comparing yourself to Chase's flies, that's just
yeah.
Recipe for failure, but man.
And then a guy that I met actually extremely recently, his name's Ben. I saw him tying some scorpions, but he was doing, instead of a hackle collar, he was doing a bunny collar for it. And so I started doing that, and I added like a little orange Dave Whitlock SLF orange mm-hmm. dubbing head, and just mm-hmm. kind of as a little hot spot. And oh my God, last time I went out, it carp were just all over it. It worked great. So,
dude, yeah. I think that guy just added me on Facebook, if I'm not mistaken, because I just saw that same thing that you were talking about. I was like, oh, dude, that's a pretty cool idea.
Dude, it looks great. I was like, yeah.
I mean, and Zonker, like the rabbit fur just moves so nice in the water too. It's
exactly.
It's,
yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. That was a great idea. So I kind of poached that idea a little bit off of him. I was like, dude, that looks too good. I'm going to go ahead and do that too. And sure enough, it worked great. So
that's freaking awesome. I think I've only ever tied one carp fly. Well, one pattern, and that's the carpet bomb. Jose taught me how to tie it. Shit. It was probably 2-3 years ago. But yeah, I need to get behind the bites a lot more, but I think what I've had the most follows and most potential catching anything on are the carpet bomb and the brass hawk. In fact, I had on a brass hawk that I ended up having a massive, I mean, I don't know how big it was. It was by far bigger than the one that I caught, like straight up chase it down. And I got too excited and pulled the hook right out of his mouth. And so I need to get more patient.
I've read there's a theory that carp are attracted to gold.
Really?
So like a lot of like brass hockey type stuff, you know, and some of the other carp flies that I tie, I try to incorporate as much kind of copper wire or just kind of brass eyes or just kind of gold accents, gold bead or whatever to kind of get their attention a little bit. But I have read that before.
That's good to know. I definitely need to incorporate that when I start tying soon.
Landon, has a carp bug bit you yet?
Yeah, I mean, I like to carp fish. I'm actually going to be moving to Lubbock soon, so that is going to be my primary fishing, it looks like, for the foreseeable future since I'm moving up there. I would categorize myself, though, very much as a variety species. So as a variety fly fisherman. So I like catching new species. And so maybe I'll get a carp bug for a little while, but I don't get the sustained carp bugs that Grant does, or that Zach Harris does, or that some of my other buddies do, where they just like, man, months at a time, three times a week, they're going out carp fishing. I could do that for like a week, but then I'm like, man, I'm going to go bass fishing, or I'm going to go trout fishing, or I'm going to go pan fishing, or I'm going to make a trip down to the coast. That's more my style. I get excited about something, and either I catch it or, you know, I move on. I don't know why. I've always been more variety kind of angler, and just mixing things up and trying new things, new species. I have a Instagram account that I haven't posted to in a while. I need to get back on there and post to it. It's called Landon's Life List, and all I do is post different species that I've caught. I won't repost a species twice, so I'm trying to like go through and like remember all the species, different species that I've caught, and just have that as like kind of like a diary of all the different species I do. And a lot of times New Year's resolutions are for me, it'll be like, I want to catch 4 new species this year. And so I'll try to figure out where those are, what they are, and how I'm going to tackle that. And that gets me excited.
Nice. Do you have any new species for this new year?
I didn't make it a New Year's resolution this year, just because I knew that I'd probably be moving. And so my New Year's resolutions have been revolved around I didn't really do any this year. I just like, there's so much on the calendar this year. That's like, that's enough as it is for this year.
So moving to Lubbock means you're going to be a bit further from the coast, a bit further from the hill country, all that stuff. Are there any species you're going to miss, like chasing while you're up there?
I think I'm going to miss being so close to the coast.
Yeah,
for sure. A lot of the, like, there are tons of carp opportunities. I was actually in Lubbock this weekend, and my brother and brother-in-law went to play disc golf. And I'm not really a disc golfer, but it's around this pond in Lubbock. And so I was hanging out with my nephew, and I didn't even take a fly rod this weekend because I didn't know I was going to have this opportunity, but walked around this pond, just, are there carp in here? And yes, there definitely are. I should have had a fly rod with me. So, I would say the coast for sure. I'm closer to New Mexico, so like I can get to trout fishing in New Mexico in about 4 hours. I'm leaving the Quad, because I'm about 45 minutes, but I'm closer to wild fish in New Mexico, and a weekend trip, 4 hours away for a weekend trip is extremely doable. So, there's bass and panfish in Lubbock too. I'm not going to have cichlids, which is kind of disappointing, but
in Guadalupe bass, I need you to say that too.
Yeah. I won't have Guadalupe bass either. I love Guadalupe bass. But also, I'm just as happy catching a largemouth too. So, I mean, not just as happy, like it's a little ding down, but like, if I want to go bass fishing, I can go bass fishing. And also like I have tons of buddies here. Like I can come back down here and go Guadalupe bass fishing. Not like moving away and just like living in my house in Lubbock. Like I'm going to come back down and visit and fish and all that kind of stuff too. So.
Yeah, when you said you were moving to Lubbock, I was like, he's not that far from New Mexico. So a couple years ago, me and Jose went up and I went to Angel Fire, New Mexico. And there's Eagle Nest State Park up there, and there's a lake there that has massive freaking pike in it. So you're not going to be too far from that either.
That sounds fun.
Yeah. Now we're talking. There's a lake in New Mexico as well that has tiger muskie.
Really?
Really?
Cool.
Yep. Yep. Chase Smith has actually fished there before. He gave a presentation on it one time. And so that's been on my mind too. Run over there and do some tiger muskie fishing.
Would be awesome. Muskie is like on one of my lists. I have a bunch of fish that I want to get on, and muskie is one of them. And I was actually looking because my girlfriend Ruth runs marathons and whatnot, and she wants to run a marathon or a half marathon in every state. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try to coincide where she wants to go with where I want to fish. And so I was like, I know there's some places in Missouri you can get on some muskie. And so I was looking up areas, and we're not finding things that coincide, but I'll make it work one day.
Does she want to run the Boston Marathon?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she does.
Yeah.
Yeah, she just ran the Little Rock Marathon. Well, she did the half this year. Last year, she ran the full marathon. And then now, like, one of the things I'm trying to coincide is I want to go to the film tour because, you know, I missed it. And then we're going to be in, when it's here in Little Rock, we're going to be in the Bahamas. So I'm not going to get to see it. So I'm looking in areas that are 3-4 hours away and hoping, it was like, well, hell, if it's Oklahoma or if it's in Missouri, like close enough, then she could run a marathon there and I can go to the film tour. And I don't think that's going to work out. So trying to coincide that as well. But yeah, she's, I think next year she's going to run the one in Florida there at Disney World. And she's starting to schedule all these to go all places. And that's all her thing. I'm not a runner.
Me either. But Florida, peacock bass.
That's exactly what I said. I was like, so I can go fishing when you're running, right? Because I'm not a Disney fan either. So I could care less if I was at the park or not.
You know what? That's funny. I saw a video today on social media that you can bass fish at Disney.
I've seen John B. do it, but illegally.
No. This was legal. Really? There is, like, I don't know what the deal is. I don't know if it's a specific guide who has access or if it's something like that. But you can bass fish. You can bass fish at Disney.
Dude, that would be pretty cool. I would assume that there's not very many people that could say they've fished at Disney.
Legally. I don't think anybody that's going to Disney is looking for fishing.
Yeah, true. That's what I was about to
say. Like, if I went to Disney, I probably wouldn't be looking to fish either. I probably won't. I mean, I like roller coasters. I like amusement parks, but also Disney, I've seen how long the lines are and how expensive it is. So it's probably not going to happen because I don't want to wait 4 hours to ride.
Yeah,
one ride. I'll go to like Six Flags on like a weekday where it's 110 degrees and nobody's there. And then I can just crank through everything in like half a day.
Right. See, I'm not a huge ride fan in general. So
yeah. A couple of years back, I had some family members go to Disney and they asked me if I wanted to go. I was like, well, I'll go, but y'all ain't going to see me. I'm going to be fishing. Y'all can do whatever y'all want.
See, that's what I'd be doing for sure. Heck yeah.
Yeah, but you know, stuff fell through. They went, I couldn't just because of school stuff, couldn't get away. But yeah, I would have ditched Disney to go fishing every single day. There's just no chance. No chance.
Anytime I take a trip anywhere, I always try to, you know, cut out some time for fishing. Last year when I was playing football still, we had playoffs in Florida and I went over there and, you know, the morning after the game, I said, all right, it's time to get up and go fishing. And so our game was in Dufuniak Springs. And then I drove down to Pensacola and tried to do some fishing down there. And it's like, it doesn't matter where I'm going, I'm trying to cut out some time. When I was in Alaska, I cut out some time. When I was in Colorado last year, I cut out some time. Like, you have to.
Yeah. Usually my trips involve some sort of fishing, like vacations and stuff like that. I'm cutting out a day or two, or the whole trip is revolved around fishing.
Right.
Much to the dismay of my girlfriend, that's how it goes.
That's kind of how I am with this cruise that we're taking. I was just like, okay, we're going to have one stop where we're not doing an excursion. Like, I'm taking a fly rod. Like, I don't know if I'm ever going to go to the Bahamas again in my life. And there's bonefish, cuda, and tarpon there. Like, why would I not? Yeah. So on that vein, have either of y'all ever fished for a bonefish or tarpon?
I have. Yeah, I've been to Belize a couple times and caught bonefish, tarpon, and a permit.
Ooh, nice. You have any tips for a beginner that's DIYing it?
And you're going for bonefish.
Yes.
Okay. I would, as far as the bonefish go, they're really difficult to see.
Okay.
Like much harder than a redfish. And redfish can be difficult to see depending on like if they're on sand or on grass or kind of the color of the water. They can be, not all the time, but a bonefish is way harder to see than a redfish, and you really want to kind of like tune your eyes to see the shadows moving because you'll almost never see them directly. What you'll see is the shadows under the water moving if the sun is at the right angle. And I found they're not super picky fly wise. It's just, it's in the same way redfish get your fly in front of them. Although you're probably going to have to cast further than you would at a redfish.
Okay.
So the distance is probably going to be a little bit farther. They're very skittish. In my experience in Belize, and again, I haven't been to the Bahamas, so I don't know if the bonefish act differently there, what the situation is. In Belize, the small fish are in big schools And they can be like 12 fish. I've seen schools of like up to 200 fish. So if you can find a school, that's your ticket, and just cast off to the edge and pull a fish off and try to keep them away from spooking the other fish. That's how you can get some really big numbers. And then the really large fish in Belize, like 4, 5, 6, 7 pounds, are either singles, doubles, or a group of three.
Okay.
And so, anyway, flies haven't really been an issue. Like if you tie like a little gotcha, mm-hmm. Or like a Christmas Island special or something small, shrimpy looking.
Yeah.
Then it shouldn't be a problem. I think the hardest thing about bonefish is actually seeing the bonefish.
Okay. Yeah. I have some, shrimpy patterns and some crabby patterns that I'm going to take down there. I bought a new fly line, when I set up my 9-weight Mangrove Coast, I didn't put very much backing on it, 'cause I didn't know at the time that I bought it. So I bought some more backing, and I'm trying to get prepared in terms of equipment and flies. And, now it's just like, I've been watching videos on YouTube and I'm like, I don't know anything about these fish. Do they intermingle with other species?
Not really. Not in my experience. I mean, they're food for other fish, like they're food for barracuda. So you're not going to you shouldn't find a barracuda or something like that where you're bone fishing. And so, in my experience, they're not really around other fish.
Okay.
Maybe permit. I will say, when I caught my permit, I caught a bonefish like 2 minutes later.
Oh, wow.
And it was kind of on the same flat. So they may co-mingle. If you caught a Bahamas permit, that would be awesome.
Right.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So yeah, permit and bonefish will be together. But I don't think you're going to find tarpon where the bonefish are. I mean, I could be wrong, but that just hasn't been my experience in Belize.
Gotcha. Well, I'm excited to get out there.
I was going to say, Russell, I think you'll probably be okay on the bonefish, 'cause from my understanding from a lot of people that go and do that kind of fishing is, I don't know. I'm under the impression that bonefish are kind of just like everybody kind of goes out and catches bonefish, and then it's like, okay, I got my fix. Now I'm going to go out for tarpon and permit and do my other thing. And like, people seem to be the least excited about bonefish versus, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But
yeah,
it's not a Landon, you tell me.
I would agree with Grant. So like, my trips to Belize have been like group trips where I take a group down to Belize. And so that has ranged from very experienced anglers to very new anglers. And everyone on that list has caught bonefish. Like, even the new anglers, like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 bonefish a day. And they're like pumped because bonefish pull hard and it's super exciting. And then the more experienced anglers, they want to catch a bonefish, and then they're like ready for a game material, which is tarpon and permit fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been my experience, but man, bonefish are super, like, pound for pound. They don't pull
hard. Oh, they're sweet. I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but you know what I mean? But
the biggest thing is, it sounds you're going on a cruise and you have like a day.
Yeah.
So you're kind of limited probably to what flats you can walk on.
Yeah.
And the amount of time that you have. My biggest thing is probably just like finding the fish.
Yep.
Like, if you can find them, you're probably going to catch them.
Okay.
But seeing them and finding them may not be super easy, but also I'm understanding the Bahamas, they should be everywhere. And if you can maybe do your research on the front end and like, okay, this is where we're going to port, this is how much time we have. And then if you can find any information about like flats that bonefish are commonly at, that will probably help you too. It'll be more beneficial than you just like walking off the boat and then walking into a flat.
Right.
Is if you can kind of, if you know that there's a flat that bonefish like to hang out on, and that's like maybe an hour walk away.
Yeah.
And you can just like spend that hour, get there, and then fish for a couple hours and then come back, as opposed to maybe spinning your wheels. Because also in Belize, bonefish aren't everywhere. They're not just like everywhere on the flat. So like the guides there and the people that fish there, they kind of know where they're at, or can get some intel really easily on where to find bonefish, but they're not everywhere.
I see. See, that was kind of my my fear, is because I called a few guides over there, and so we're gonna, the port that we're gonna be at where we're not doing an excursion is gonna be Freeport. So we're gonna be we're going to Freeport, Nassau, and Half Moon Cay, and we're doing excursions on the other two. So in Freeport, we're not doing an excursion. And so I was like, okay. So I called a few of the bonefish charters out there, fly fishing charters, and they said, yeah, we don't do anybody that, you know, that'll walk beaches with you, or we don't have any half day guides. Like, they're talking about, I'll get on the boat and going somewhere. And I'm like, well, damn, does that mean that there's not very many of them in Freeport? And so that was my fear. I was like, ah. But from everything that I've seen, like, I've even looked up specifically Freeport fly fishing bonefish on YouTube, and there's a bunch of videos. So I don't know if they're just leaving from Freeport and they're considering that video to be Freeport for that reason, or if the guides just try to get people on bigger fish. So that's what I'm kind of, I've tried to, you know, yep, get some intel, but you know, if I'm, yeah, not hiring them, they're not going to give up much.
Man, if the best thing that you can do is walk off the boat and go on a flat, that's awesome. You're going to get half a day fishing for bonefish. But right, if you can just, like, just a little bit of information.
Exactly.
Because I think the hard part in what you're doing is going to be finding the fish. If you can find the fish, you've caught carp. You know, I know that you're a good angler. That part's going to come together. The casting to the fish, you know, putting the fly in front of them. But I think the big thing is going to be finding the fish and then seeing the fish too. And just get your eyes adjusted to seeing bonefish.
Right. Well, that's going to be a big, yeah, tip, because probably what I was going to do is just walk along the beach till I saw something. And if I didn't know to look for shadows, I probably would have never seen them.
Yeah. They're hard to see. Cause if you see them, they're kind of like, they're very silvery. So they blend in very well, and they kind of have like an olive color, like stripe pattern, but just depending on the sun, man, they're, and school's definitely easier, mm-hmm, to see them. And if you know how to find like nervous water, that's super helpful too. I've seen bonefish tail one time, but the tide was super low. So, you know, finding tails is probably not going to be super reliable either, like it can be for redfish.
I see. And did you catch your permit on a similar fly that you caught the bonefish on?
Yeah, I caught the bonefish on the same fly I caught the permit on. Okay. It was like I don't even know what the pattern is. It's a super simple crab pattern, like a felt bodied crab with like brown striped rubber legs. Like, okay, there's nothing to it. I can actually probably, if you guys give me a second, I can grab it and show it to you. Yeah, let me grab it real quick.
That'd be cool.
You do much saltwater fishing, Grant?
I do, yeah. I try to get down as much as I possibly can, but I've got like a little micro skiff, so I try to get down there as much as I can.
Nice.
Yeah. Mainly just, you know, still figuring out the red fisheries that I... Oh, nice, Landon. There you go.
I like that. That's, yeah, pretty sweet.
Yeah, this is the actual fly I caught the permit on, so...
Oh, wow.
I kept it. It's pretty cool. I cycled through probably 40 flies, though.
I see.
On permit. So that's just a different monster.
Yeah.
You just gotta, luck.
Right.
Honestly. So
the reason I asked that question is because I didn't want to be walking and then, you know, obviously see a black tail and be like, oh, there's permit. And it's like, oh, well, do I got to change my fly? But if they mainly the same thing, then I'd probably just throw the same fly I had on for the bonefish anyways.
In Belize, they like to use crabs, mm-hmm, for the permit. And when we're like specifically bonefish fishing, that has been more like small shrimpy patterns.
I see.
But if you see a permit, like, cast at it.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, doesn't matter what the fly you have on. you'll either get really lucky or you won't. I mean, that's just the best advice, right, I can give. Because when I caught my permit, there were probably like, we came up to a flat and it had probably like 100 permit on the flat. And, we were running, chasing schools, like in the water, literally like sprinting to catch, because they move fast too. So we were running in the water, catch up to a school, throw a cast at the school. They don't take it. We're going to change flies real quick. We're going to run to another school. We're going to find another fish. And that went on for about an hour and a half. And then I finally hooked up on one.
Dude, that's so awesome.
It was crazy chaos and awesome luck too. So, and learning how to, like, I'd never, like, I would be like running and casting at the same time. And like doing that is just like cause for disaster. Like, add that to your training regimen if you're going to go permit fishing. So, And so I threw a lot of bad casts too, but I threw some good casts that they didn't eat on. And I was throwing at groups of fish, and it was just wild. It was just wild.
That sounds insane. It almost sounds like the same process of like rooster fishing from the beach in Baja and stuff like that.
I would imagine so. 100%. Like what I know about that.
The walking it's your down running, the man.
Yeah, nope. Running down the beach, casting the Huron.
Yeah, sorry.
Casting, you know, because they just move in and out so quick. Your opportunity is just so slim, and they're spooky, and they pull hard. Because I had actually hooked a permit before I caught that one, mm-hmm. I had broken it off. So on a different day, that wasn't the same day. It wasn't that same flat where I had hooked one, but I had one eat. I wouldn't even say I had it hooked. And it ate the fly so hard that it jerked my hand forward, and I had too much pressure on my line. I wasn't expecting it to hit it that hard mm-hmm. when it ate the fly. It almost pulled the rod out of my hand, and the line broke.
That's insane.
Immediately. So
see, I'm excited for something like that. Like I hooked it. So last year or the year before, I caught a 54 inch bull red down in Venice, and that was freaking amazing. But the one that I hooked before that was much bigger, and I had never caught a redfish on the fly before, and I took a guide and I was down there and I made the perfect cast, and she turned on it and she ate, and I was just shaking. I had so much adrenaline, I didn't even know what was going on, and I dropped my fly rod, and like the fly line was wrapped around the reel. I almost fell off the casting platform. Like it was a nightmare. And so by the time I grabbed my rod and had everything, I mean, the line was all inside my fingers and all around the reel and everything. And she just broke off immediately. And I mean, it was huge. I told my buddy Brian, because me and him went out there. I said, Brian, you need to take the platform for a little bit, because I was shaking. It's like, I need to calm myself down before I get another chance. And I ended up catching the one that I caught. But the one before that was much bigger.
That high stress, like fishing too, is like you want to prepare yourself for, like, it's hard to recreate those. Like, when you're teaching somebody how to fight a fish, you can't like tell them how to fight a fish. Mm-hmm. They need to do it, and they need to mess it up a couple times, and they need to learn from it. But you can also, like in these situations, like where you're tarpon fishing, you may have a lot of line on the deck, is like prepare yourself. And if you strip your line out, you need to cast all your line out and then strip it in a nice pile. Because if you just strip it off your reel and lay it on the deck, it's actually upside down. And that's a cause for it getting tangled. So strip all your line out, cast all your line, strip it into a nice pile. So that way, if you hook into something nice, it's a lot more manageable. So like there's little things that you can do that just help you out when it comes to like tarpon or permit or big redfish that are just going to eat the fly, and they're just going to peel line. You want to set yourself up for success on the front end and kind of have everything that you can control. You want to have under control, because you're not going to be able to control, you know, some things that are going to happen. But right. I had a fish. I don't remember what it was. I had hooked into a jack in Belize, and a knot had gotten in my line, and it went through the guides, and it was like halfway through my fly line. And so the guide had jumped off the platform and was like, we were trying to keep hand tension on the fish while he was trying to undo this knot in the line, so that way I could reel it in. Cause if you put a knot through the guides, that's asking for your rod breaking basically. And the fish ended up coming off, but like, you know, things like that happen. And if you can do everything you can to prevent that, you don't want to hook into like a 200 pound tarpon, and because your line was a mangled mess when you were casting at it, you're just lowering. That's like a once in a lifetime fish. Your odds are lowered because you didn't do the prep work on the front end.
Right. See, I had an issue, I guess it was Thursday maybe of last week, that I lost this freaking hog of a koi that I hooked right out here behind where I live. because of a freaking knot. I was so mad at myself. And so I was fishing in probably like 5 foot tall cattails. And so I don't ever steeple cast, but I was having a steeple cast because it's a hill behind me, cattails beside me. And then I'm casting like right into where there's just a bunch of crap in the water. And there's a bunch of koi that like to run out here with the carp. And Jose caught one a couple years ago. And there was this hog. It was like a calico colored orange, white, and black koi just kind of chilling. And so I made a few casts at it, and I made a perfect cast. It was like 3 feet past it, and I had on a little fly that was, it looked like some type of mollusk, and Jose actually tied him up for me, and it had some chenille, almost looked like a worm coming out of it. And I dropped it past it, and I just barely twitched it, and I saw the fish kind of turn, and then I twitched it a little, let it sit, and I saw the tail come up, and I see a little poof of mud, and I set the hook, and it took off. And then I was like, oh, crap. And so I cleared the line and I start finding it. And right when it got to my reel, just broke off. And I was like, damn it, because I didn't think I got a good hook set. So I start, you know, stripping it in, getting ready to hopefully make another cast at another. And I looked and I had a wind knot in my freaking line, in my leader. And it snapped right at that wind knot. And I was just like, damn it. If I was just a better caster, if I had practiced a steeple cast, like I wouldn't have had that issue, you know. And it was a nice freaking koi. It was the biggest koi that I've ever seen out there.
Yeah, man, stuff like that. I think of like the 1% rule, which is like if you can do anything that increases your odds by at least 1%, it's worth doing. Mm-hmm. So like tying your fly on with a good knot, like checking your leaders, checking your fly line loop, make sure it's not like frayed or anything before you go out fishing.
Right.
Wearing clothes that kind of hide you. Like I'm not into like the where I'm gonna camo out to go fishing, but like don't wear like a bright orange, you know, shirt out fishing. There's just like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Making sure your fly line's like nicely in a pile if you're casting to a good fish. All those little things make a difference.
Yeah.
And if you can like improve on those like little 1% things, like the amount of fish you catch is definitely going to go way higher.
Exactly. I wouldn't be telling the story if I just checked my leader.
No, you would have been telling us how you caught this hog of a koi, right? And you were pumped, and it'd be a different story.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. I'm so bad about checking my leaders, man. I never do it. I need to start getting that.
I'm not like saying that I'm like a perfect, because I'll like use a leader that's been on my rod for like 8 months. Like the last one I was like 8 months ago, and I'll break a fish off. So like I'm breaking all these rules I'm talking about too. Yeah. So like I got to remind myself this much as well. And, you know, there's a difference too. Like I kind of have two fishing modes. It's like, I need to go fishing today. Like I need to be outside and I need to be in the water. And I'm like less concerned about, you know, all of those things. Or it's like, I'm going tarpon fishing. Like I'm tying flies. I'm gonna make sure that they look great. All my leaders are going to be like tied perfectly. And the knots are going to be great. Like there's a difference too between the types of even the fishing that I'll go out and do.
Yeah, that type of trip, I'm sure you want to be prepared for.
Yeah, for sure. Or even if you're just doing like a trip that you get to do maybe like once a year, like, oh, I'm driving up to New Mexico, or, you know, oh, I'm going to go to the Bahamas, you know, like you get these like little glimpses of like this different type of fishing. And you just want to like, when you get those opportunities, it's different than going to the koi pond in your backyard that you can go fish every day.
Right.
You know, That's why you said you're tying flies and, you know, checking your fly line and making sure you're ready to go and making sure all your gear's good.
Exactly.
Cause all that stuff does make a difference when you have these like little opportunities.
Yep. Limited time, limited access. It's not like I'm going to be going there every year or anything like that. I definitely want to make sure. You know, I've dotted all my I's and crossed all my T's. So
for sure. Definitely
excited. So is there any events going on in Central or South Texas that y'all know of coming up?
Trout Fest passed.
Trout Fest. How about this? Once a month, Chris Kowaleski with Ditch Fish and Flies. Mm-hmm. We are putting on a tie night at Middleton Brewing once a month. So, nice. That's a great time. And it's been a pretty good turnout the last couple months, especially. So if anybody's interested, then feel free to get in contact with me and I'll point you to in the right direction.
Middleton Brewing's in San Marcos, right?
Yeah. It's actually kind of outside of San Marcos in between, it's kind of in between Wimberley and San Marcos. So it is a little bit of a drive, and I understand that like it is a drive, but it's a good time if you happen to be in the area.
That's awesome. And when do y'all do that?
We do it on Tuesdays. Let's see. The next one is going to be, I think, actually next week. We're doing it on Tuesdays. And we're starting to get a little bit more organized with them. So we're actually trying to kind of promote them a little bit better. And we're Middleton Brewery. You can also follow Middleton Brewery. They're pretty good about starting to keep a better schedule on when we're going to have them, because we're kind of shooting at the hip whenever we first started and just kind of last minute come together. But now it's kind of a little bit more formal. So,
awesome.
I'll make sure and I'll repost it. And then also, if you want to follow Middleton Brewing, they'll repost it as well.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I think it was the 26th, something like
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out what
Chris has been trying to get me to go to those. And I want to so bad, but I mean, College Station, because I got
you're Kyle. Exactly. But, like, it's what, freaking 2.5-3 hours for you? I mean, I get it.
Yeah, about 2.5. But I mean, like, the thing is, like, I have family in Kyle, and I go back home all the time. Like, I was there last weekend. I'm probably going to go back another weekend. I don't know if this weekend or the next, but so it's not that, but like, it just sucks because on Tuesdays, especially this semester, it's my busy day. Like, my day starts like 4:30, don't end till 5, and it's just, I can't get out of class and then go make the drive. And
no, sucks, man. Dude. And look, it's a little far for me. Like, the part of town I live on with traffic at like that time of the day, it's just like it would be impossible. So
So I get it. You know, you can make it.
I would love to go.
I'm gonna make it at one point. Try.
Yeah,
to.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, next semester. It's not going to end anytime soon. So, you know, and we've even talked about, you know, Chris is with his job, he gets a little bit busier in the spring. So it sounds like I'm going to kind of take over some more responsibilities, organizing some things. And then whenever he slows back down, he'll take it back over. It's definitely Chris's kind of deal, but I'm helping. So,
yeah.
That's awesome. That's sick, I'd like to say I'd make it to one, but that's
a little bit of a drive. Fly on in, man.
Right?
You crash on the couch.
9.5-hour drive.
Hey, Russell, I heard you did a conservation snow goose hunt recently.
I did.
How many birds did you shoot?
I got the numbers fudged up, Lynn. That was on me.
Oh.
So let me tell this story. Was it more? Let me tell this story. So I went up to it's kind of northeast Arkansas to go on this conservation snow goose hunt. And the guy
that people that don't know, that's, you can shoot as many birds as you want.
Yeah, there's, you can shoot as many birds as you want. You don't have to have plugs in your shotguns. Basically, it's,
you can get extenders.
Yeah, you just go and mow down the birds, because what they're doing is they're tearing up their breeding grounds up north. So certain times of year, they're allowing you to just pretty much eradicate them.
You got banana clips coming out.
a hundred round drum.
That would be awesome. Semi-auto 12 gauge. We get out there and we're supposed to be going with this guy who was going with somebody that he knew. And we get up there and what we're going to do is we're going to try to hunt just private lands. And so we're cruising all around trying to find birds and fields. And so we drove for like 2-3 hours just trying to find anything. And we found this, I mean, massive plot of birds. But, and I pulled up my Onyx Hunt app and I found out who the owner was, and it was some holdings company. We couldn't get a hold of anybody to see if we could ask the owner for permission or nothing. And I was like, you know, I have my girlfriend and my daughter with me, and this is their first time hunting. I'm not going to, you know, potentially get caught for poaching, you know, their first time hunting. So I said, it'd be a good idea to not do that. So we just kept driving, and we were calling people, and I don't know anybody in the area. And so the guy that I was with was calling people he knew. And this guy called us and he's like, dude, there's thousands of birds in this field. We got permission to hunt. Like, y'all get over here. And he dropped a pin. It was like 26 miles away or 26 minutes away. And we're like, all right, sweet. So we had to stop for gas. We didn't have enough gas to get there. So we're on the way, pull over for gas. I take the girls in to use the restroom, walk out. My buddy's like, you ain't gonna believe this. I said, what? He's like, dude, I got a flat. I'm like, fuck, how bad is it? Like, can we at least make it there? And I look, and dude, it's on the rim. I don't know how he didn't feel it on these dirt roads, but he was on the rim, and he has a 3/4-ton truck, and all he had was a bottle jack. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And so we changed the tires as fast as we could. We get over there and we go through this pocket of no service. And the guy that we were talking to apparently was trying to call us and call us and call us. And so we get to this dirt road that we had to pull off of, and we see this berm, and we see all their trucks, and we see them all laying on the backside of the berm. We're like, sweet, we made it in time. We turn on the road and they bust the birds. They didn't, like, we were 15 seconds too late. And so thousands of birds start flying up, and between eight of them and they each were only just using, you know, 5 shells each. They killed 398 birds with 40 shells. I was like,
wow.
So you weren't part of that. You got to watch it.
I got to watch it. So then we pull up and we're like, damn. Well, then we look over on the same property owner's land. We saw two other areas that were holding birds. And so like, shit, we're going to try to go over there. So we pull up and these two young guys pull up in a side by side and they're like, hey, are y'all with them? Like, this is my grandpa's property, this and that. We're like, yeah, we were supposed to be with them. We didn't make it in time. And they're like, yeah, well, y'all can come with us. And so, I mean, I was like, oh, thanks. Like, y'all are freaking awesome. So me and my girlfriend and daughter hopped on their side by side and we go, you know, driving through this pond to try to flank the birds. And right when we get to the backside of the berm, we don't even get up on the berm yet. And for some reason, the birds busted. I guess they were already spooked because of the other flock. And we only got 5 birds. So we could have had a lot more. But I mean, hey, it was my first time going goose hunting. And it was my girlfriend and daughter's first time ever hunting at all. So we got 5 birds. It was worth it. And it was a good time. But yeah, it's a conservation hunt is nuts.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do one. They're just like so far away from here. Like right. If I was there, that's one thing. But like doing a big trip.
Yeah.
It always ends up seeming difficult to pull together.
Yeah. And that weekend, I wasn't sure how it was going to go because everything that I saw. So there's a snow goose migration like Facebook page. And I've noticed a big difference between snow goose conservation hunters and fly anglers. Nobody wants to share information. And so constantly people were like, is there still goose in this area? And me, the type of person I'm like, yeah, dude, I saw some. I was driving here and I saw this. Everybody's like, geese don't even come here. Like, everybody's just like, I mean, I guess they're messing with each other, but nobody gives any pertinent information on anything. And I was like, why y'all gotta be like that? Like, we're all, you know, trying to do the same thing. But everybody's saying in general,
it's a conservation hunt.
I see it. Well, the thing is with conservation hunt though, is like, you're not doing it on public land. You're doing it on private land. So what does it matter?
It's not exactly like
hunting the person.
Yeah. That, you're still gonna have to get permission.
Exactly. So it doesn't make sense to me, but everybody was basically saying that the geese were flying north and they were pretty much out of there. And then I was seeing a lot of people in South Dakota with like freaking blowing them out in South Dakota the same weekend that we were supposed to be hunting in Arkansas. And I was like, damn, so they have flown out. Well, we got a cold front like the Thursday or Friday before that weekend and a bunch of them have moved back down south. And so we're driving up and we're probably 30 minutes from where we were going to be. We had not seen one goose yet. And I was like, man, they still are out. And then we started getting in, you know, within 20, you know, 15 minutes from where we're going to be. And we just started seeing flocks of them, just thousands of them flying. And I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. So I definitely plan on going back next year. But it was fun for a first try, you know?
Yeah, no, that sounds – I've always wanted to do that. One thing I'm excited about in Lubbock is I've done a crane hunt a couple times up in Lubbock. And I'm excited to do that more often.
Ribeye the sky.
Yeah, ribeye the sky, man.
Yeah, this year I'm going to go on one. I'm super stoked.
That's a hunt I really want to go on, man. I knew a girl. She did a sandhill crane study in South Texas where I was going to school. And those things are vicious. She would come like to class all like scratched to hell and everything. She's like, dude, those things will mess you up. It's crazy, man.
They go for your eyes, right? That's the
yeah. They would have to wear goggles and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The dogs, they put the goggles on the dogs because if the dogs go out there and one's still alive, I mean, their head is tiny compared to their body. They got like a 9-foot wingspan. And so you'll down one, but maybe not kill it because you didn't shoot it in the head because their heads are tiny. Mm-hmm. And so you got to go out there with a club and finish it off. And they're just, I've never encountered a vicious one, but like the people that hunt them a lot, they're like, you got to be careful. They're mean.
Dude. And you walk up and they're like a 4-foot bird and you're just like locking eyes. You're like, oh damn. All right. Let's go.
About to go down.
Bro. It's crazy, man. They're a different beast.
No, I'm hoping to put together like a buddy hunt every year when I move up there and like just get a big group of guys to come up for a weekend and just sandhill crane hunt.
Dude, that would be awesome. I'll hope you're
right. I'll invite you guys.
I'll be there.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet.
That's freaking sweet. Awesome. Yeah, dude, I plan on going this year and it's going to be exciting. So I'm assuming you've got them before.
I haven't shot many. I think I've shot 2 maybe. Like I've done 2 hunts and, just they're smart birds too. Like the limit's 3, so you can't shoot a lot of them, but they're also super smart birds. And I mean, they're all over Lubbock, but just like anything else, fishing or whatever, you can have lucky days if they want to fly in to your spread, or you can have unlucky days. Yeah. So, you know, it seems like I've always got to shoot at birds, but we just weren't having like tons and tons of them come in.
I see. That's freaking awesome though. Yeah. I'm excited to try one. Cause like the, so I've heard so many people say that snow goose just isn't that good. And I cooked them both. I cooked all of them, and I made two different recipes. I made fajitas with one, and I made pulled barbecue sandwiches with the other. And they're freaking amazing. My kids, they went back for seconds and everything. Like, it was great meat. I don't know why people say that they don't like them, but I'm excited to try sandhill because I know everybody says that it's really
good. I was going to say, I just think it's how you prep them, because when I was in Kingsville, we used to hunt duck hunt on the coast all the time. But those birds, they always say, are nasty too, like redheads and stuff. The divers versus dabblers. Divers are supposed to be nasty. It tastes like mud or whatever. The ones I've had have been great, but they say that the key is to not overcook them, because if you, mm-hmm. you have to cook them like rare, medium rare, if you're going to cook it like a steak. And if anything beyond that, they get super tough. Like, the consistency is almost like liver. Even the taste is almost like liver. I've had duck where it was like overcooked or cooked slightly too long, and it was not good. But yeah. if you cook it medium rare or whatever, it's friggin', it's phenomenal.
It's the same story with antelope too. I think antelope, in my opinion, is one of the best game meats I've ever had in my life. And for whatever reason, it gets a bad rap. I think a big part of that is because people run them down with their trucks and get the body heat going, and it just kind of spoils the meat pretty quickly. They probably don't gut it quick enough, but antelope's delicious.
So what about that owdad?
Oh yeah, we've got all that. I've got a little family place out kind of in between Van Deren and Kerrville. We've got all that out there, and all that is delicious as well. I mean,
because I've heard it's nasty. Well, I got a buddy, he's got a ranch in Del Rio. He said that our dad is both the best meat he's ever had, and it's also the worst meat he's ever had.
Well, that's like pigs too, in my opinion. Yeah. I've had some terrible pigs, and I've had some great ones.
Yeah.
So I don't know that. I don't. Maybe what their particular diet is, or maybe the geography where they came from,
diet too. It could be like stress before death.
Yeah.
Like, affects the taste of the meat. So like, if people are running down antelope in their trucks, like, that's a pretty stressful way for them to go.
Exactly.
As opposed to looking up on them and, you know, placing an ethical shot somewhere where their death will be quick. So that probably has a lot to do with it as well. And then their diet, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know enough about this to say anything, but you know, what they're eating affects their taste too. It's just, do you know what they're eating at that time when you shoot them, or that's going to be hard to figure out, I think.
Exactly. And I imagine a lot of it's also how, like, you prep the animal, like field dress it. I got a, like, javelinas, they have a bunch of scent glands all over them. You pop one of those and that thing is like toast.
Yeah.
Toast.
And I've heard, I've never hunted owdad. I've had it once, but it was at a restaurant. And it was great. I've never had it that someone else prepared. And but supposedly there's like some glands in an owdad too, that if you puncture one of those, and it kind of sours meat a bit. I don't know if that's true or not though.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, you know, for the big males and stuff, we're usually using those to grind in for sausage and that kind of thing. But I mean, I don't know. I don't take any precautions as far as like missing any particular glands. I just clean them like I do a white-tailed deer, and they always tend to be fine. But yeah, I mean, a smaller female owdad, you can stake that out. And like I said, I think it's great. I mean, yeah, bad rap for whatever reason.
One of the best meals I've ever had was chicken fried antelope, Grant, at the Starlight Theater in Big Bend.
Oh, yeah.
Terlingua.
I believe it.
Yeah. Oh, I actually liked it so much, we went there and ate again, and I got the same thing. And I rarely do that.
No.
So, on the same vacation, to eat the same restaurant twice so you can eat the same meal again.
What was that place called?
It was Starlight Theater. It's Interlingua.
Yeah. If you take care of that meat, I'm telling you, antelope is delicious. It really is. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good place. Definitely go check it out for sure.
A, there's a place in Austin. My buddy and I actually went this past weekend called Die Dewey.
Jesse Griffin.
Die Dewey's great.
I had never been there before.
Yeah.
And it was my first time going. And the place is awesome. The service is great. The food, it's all wild game based. And they try and source as much of the ingredients from Texas. The salt they use came from Padre Island. And so like a lot of the vegetables and things too, local farmers and stuff. Like it's great. But he ordered, it was a like an Aodad falafel or something, like a gyro or whatever. Dude.
That sounds delicious.
He let me try. Like he's like, dude, you got to try this. And he cut me off a little piece of the meatball. Bro, it was one of the, not just for wild game, but just in general, one of the best things I ever tasted. It was fantastic.
That sounds
super
amazing.
Good. Dude, if you ever get the chance to go check it out, highly recommend.
It's a great restaurant. I went for my birthday a couple years ago. It was awesome.
I need to go check it out. Do we need to try to get Jesse Griffiths on the podcast?
Yeah, no kidding. That'd be a big get for sure, man. That guy's awesome.
Yeah. And he ordered a, what was it? It was a crawfish. It was essentially a crawfish empanada. Dude, that shit was part of my language, but it was awesome.
I'd eat it.
I'm not going to lie. I'd throw that down.
He wrote, what is it called, Landon? Isn't it the hog book?
He wrote the hog book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about processing wild hog and recipes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then he also, his first book is called A Field, which is a wild game cookbook. I have a copy of that as well. That one's really good. Both books are really good. Yeah. If you're into like collecting that style of book, I would highly recommend both of them.
The hog book, my buddy, the one I went to lunch with, he went to this thing. I think it was a Stewards of the Wild event, and Jesse was there. He was a guest speaker, and he was giving away the hog book as a prize for something. And he had won it, and he had gifted it to me. I have it there. But in his shop, you can buy the copies of that book. There's another book called The Turkey Book, and it's all about processing turkey and cooking turkey. And then they have the one that Landon mentioned. I can't remember what that one's called.
I didn't know he had a turkey book.
I didn't either. I don't know if it's soon to be released or what, but they have copies there in the actual restaurant. You can buy it too. Yeah.
So y'all were talking about, obviously the taste of the meat comes from the way that it was, you know, harvested and also the way it's prepped. So have y'all ever heard of Ikejime?
Yes. I was about to say that where they, it's like a humane way to kill a fish or whatever.
Yeah. So it's insane. Yeah. So basically it's the most expensive Japanese sushi restaurants. The way that they process their fish is they'll catch the fish and then they have this almost like a skewer that they run down the spinal cord of the fish. And they've done a blind taste test before where they have killed the fish and one using Ikejima and one just throwing it on ice like a lot of other people do, you know, bleeding it and putting it on ice. And then they have filleted it and eaten it, you know, sashimi. And they taste very similar, fresh. Well, then what they did is they went and left the one with Ikejima out on the counter for 4 days, non-refrigerated. Put the other one in the fridge for 4 days and taste tested it. And everybody swore the one that was left on the counter was the one that was left in the fridge because it's so fresh. It's because there's no adrenaline running through the fish or anything like that. And it's like this old historic Japanese way of preparing the fish. So you should look into it. I'll see if I can find the video that I watch and I'll send it to you. They did it with striper of all things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fish eater. So you can count me out for that one.
I love eating fish.
If people say it's better, that's great. I can promise you right now, I ain't eaten any fish that's been left on the counter for 4 days.
So there's a, like an equivalent, but for hunting, but it's a device. They call it the one that I don't know if there's others, but the one I'm looking at now, it's called the Tenderbuck Electrostimulator. So apparently after you kill the animal, whatever, you hook it up to this thing. It's supposed to, I guess, relax the muscles and just like help it bleed out more and whatever. So more efficiently, I guess. So you get a more tender product at the end.
That kind of actually makes sense. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I think they should find a different name. It sounds like a sex toy.
I was thinking it, but I wasn't gonna say
that. That might make it more popular. I don't know.
Yeah,
it might.
Tender buck.
Dude, the thing is $300.
I mean,
it might be worth it.
If it makes your meal better.
I mean, I would try it if I had access to it. I don't know if I'd spend $300 to find out.
Yeah, I wouldn't spend the money to try it.
It might encourage rigor mortis to leave the animal quicker or something. Like, you know, I almost picture like what are those machines that they used to use, or it's like little circles that stick to your body. Yeah, defibrillator. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Oh, wait, no, that's for the emergency thing. I know what you're talking about, though.
But yeah, like they stick on your muscles and kind of send pulses through and contract mm-hmm. your muscles and kind of.
It's called a stem or something like that. It's a God, what are they called? I used to use
it. But it seems like that might be kind of useful for tenderizing meat. You know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I'm gonna go buy some steaks and throw them on there and see what it does.
I mean, when you think about it, like an animal, after everything's happened, it's got adrenaline going through there before it dies, whatever. Like it's super tense. This could, I mean, I could see how it could help. I just don't know if it actually would.
Yeah.
Maybe you could watch some reviews on it.
Maybe.
So we're coming up on close to the time to where we got to start cutting this out. So I want to ask one question to everybody before we get off. Me and Jose have answered this question. But I will ask y'all too. If y'all had anywhere y'all could go, doesn't matter the time, the money, anything like that, to chase one fish, what would it be?
How about this? If someone walked into your house right now and gave you a golden ticket, it could take you anywhere in the world to fish for anything, like right then and there.
I would go to Mongolia and fish for taiman.
Ooh,
that's good. Awesome. Yeah.
And part of that is the experience, because they're like overnight floats that you do and you stay in yurts, and it's like you're really kind of immersed in the Mongolian culture while you're doing that, which is sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. But then you get to fish for like a prehistoric salmonoid fish that gets to up to like 100 pounds. I mean,
that's pretty
even bigger than 100 pounds. I mean, I don't know if you guys seen pictures of them, but it's just absolutely nuts. And you can also catch trout while you're fishing for them. And there's pike in the same rivers. So just the overall trip sounds awesome.
It does, for sure.
So for me, it seems like people are either going to go Dorado or GT. It seems like I think I'm fall more on the GT. Like, I think I'd like to go to Australia with the goal of catching GT, but also Australia has quite a plethora of species to choose from while you're there as well. So I think that'd probably be the...
You can catch permit while you're there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's...
And all the freshwater stuff you can do there too seems really cool. They have like really unique bass, you know, endemic there. Mm-hmm. There.
And all the snakes that can kill you. So that's...
Yeah. And spiders too.
And part of the jellyfish.
Yeah.
Saltwater crocs, great whites.
Great whites, all that good stuff.
Oh, dude, I want to catch a barramundi. Just because the table fare. Dude, it tastes so freaking good.
You've had it.
Yes, I've had barramundi. So there's this company called Factor, and it's... So have y'all heard of HelloFresh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they do like pre-made meals also, to where you don't cook it, and it's almost like meal prep. And I do that for my lunches, and it's that sometimes I'll spoil myself. So there's premium ones, and then there's the regular ones. The regular ones, you'll get like a pork tomato ragu, or you'll get like a chicken tortilla pasta. It's like, it's all real good stuff. But then they have the premium products that you can add on for $6, $11, whatever. And one of them was barramundi one time. And I said, I'm just going to go ahead and add that on there. And dude, it was freaking good. I don't even remember what it was with. It had like Brussels sprouts and then barramundi with some other toppings. God, it was so freaking good.
Did they leave it on the counter for 4 days?
They do, actually, unrefrigerated. No, they send it with ice blocks and everything. And I think their slogan is fresh, never frozen. And then you just throw it in the fridge and, you know, eat them as that. And I have this little hot plate that I keep in my work truck because I travel so much for work. And I just throw them in there for about 30 minutes and they're good to go. And it's freaking good. Even reheated like that, the barramundi was amazing. Is that Guadalupe we hear in the background?
Oh, yeah, Lupe. Yeah, actually, here, nice. Let me go ahead and... she's calling to come in.
Dude, she looks like she's grown a little bit.
Yeah, she has. She's getting pretty big.
That's pretty
she's
awesome.
Like, she is such a cool cat, man. She's been great. But yeah, that's funny that she made the little cameo right at the end.
I feel like that's a fitting end to the podcast. Oh, Lupe right. making an appearance.
Heck yeah, man. Little cameo. Jose, man, I've been taking a deep dive on your profile lately, man. I'm really impressed. Very talented tire, man. Really good job.
Oh, man. I appreciate it, dude. We're going to have to sit down and do some tying sometime, bro, or some fishing.
Absolutely, man. You'll have to show me some stuff, man. I've been working on some kind of little Marabou-y things, but yeah, I've been really impressed with a lot of your stuff. So I wanted to just say props.
Oh, man, I appreciate the kind words, bro. You got some good stuff too, dude.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah, if you ever want to swap some flies or anything, man, let me know.
Let's do it. Well, I already have plans to send Russell some stickers and stuff. So maybe we can work out a whole deal where we just all send each other our own swag and flies and just have a good time with it.
Dude, we can definitely do it.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Was there anything else y'all wanted to talk about before we get out of here?
Oh, wait, one thing. I know we talked about the Iron Fly movie. I don't think we told people what it's called or where they can watch it. If you guys want to
share that. Yeah. So the movie's called Brotherhood, and it's on my YouTube channel, or the Honey Hole Angling YouTube channel. And so it's our most recent video. So if you guys go there, I'm sure that Russell and Jose can put a link to the video in the comments.
Yep.
And you guys can go watch that video. It's 12 minutes. Sit through the whole thing. The banger is at the end. I promise you that. You're going to want to watch the last part of the film. And the film takes you through what a real recovery retreat looks like. And kind of does interviews with people that, you know, are involved with the retreat. So if you want to learn about what real recovery does, it's hard to explain what happens on the retreat if you haven't seen it. And this is an opportunity for you guys to go in and watch and see what a retreat looks like and how it impacts these men that go on it.
That's awesome. Well, I'll definitely put a link to it in the description. So for all the listeners out there, y'all definitely need to check it out.
And make sure you guys go to Grant's. Grant has a YouTube channel as well, Hill Country Flyworks. He does a lot of great videos. Go check his stuff out as well. And then on Instagram, photography is getting better every day.
Thanks.
So go check Grant out on Instagram as well.
Thanks.
For sure.
Yep. And I love watching his stuff. There's just something about the POV that it just makes it feel like you're there sometimes.
Heck yeah, man. Well, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
And not a problem. We appreciate y'all hopping on for the podcast.
Heck yeah. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, not a problem. This is awesome.
Yes, sir. We'll catch y'all next time.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.